From Brighton on the English South Coast, these are the voices of the Royal Pavilion and Museums with Dr. Sophie Frost.
In this penultimate episode, I talk to Kevin Bacon, Digital Manager at Royal Pavilion and Museums, Brighton and Hove. The emerging role of digital in museums is fundamental to One by One, the research project led by the School of Museum Studies at the University of Leicester, which enabled this podcast series in the first place. Indeed, I created this podcast as a sort of experimental exercise in what I'm calling digital courage, where I hoped that staff would feel empowered using basic technology to tell their own stories and share their own experiences of working in the museum, thus generating an alternative and accessible type of digital content for the museum service. Kevin takes us on a whistle-stop tour of his own lived experience of working with digital at the museum over the past couple of decades, and at the same time provides some fascinating insights into how digital has tried, failed, and tried again to make collections audience-friendly.
My name's Kevin Bacon. I'm the digital manager for the Royal Pavilion and Museums. I've been working there since, back in 2003 I started. So I've been working there now about 16 years in a variety of roles. And I landed up in museums completely by accident, actually. I just finished doing a master's degree in digital media, and I was just about to start a self-funded PhD. A job advert came up for the library service, went for an interview, and they said, actually, we're not going to give you the job, but there is possibly an opportunity to do some work in the old local studies library, as was, helping to basically shift some boxes over into the museum. So I started doing that for a few weeks, realised that I couldn't afford the PhD and was going to have to abandon it rather rapidly. And at the time, a lot of other people in that library service, which was about to become Brighton History Centre and Brighton Museum, a few people left, and I thought, well, actually, your museum's not necessarily a bad place to work. It sort of aligns with a lot of things I'm quite interested in, even though I'd never seriously thought of a museum career. Which is quite strange, because actually my mother worked for the museum, which is possibly one reason why I didn't consider it at all as a place to work. So yeah, I really started, as I say, sort of shifting boxes from a sort of dank and mouldy old basement into a newly kitted out room in Bright Museum, where Museum Lab is now. I became a bit like a library officer in that room, kind of helping inquirers come in with their research requests. And it was actually really interesting backing for what I do now, because it really made me learn how to understand how people engage with history. That seldom people can articulate, particularly if you're thinking about access to historic materials. And in fact, we're obviously talking today in the Keep, where some of my old colleagues from the History Centre still work, and has a very similar model. And there's something really important about, you know, the role of an officer or someone who works in the inquiry service, how they deliver service to the public, because often it's about that very subtle art and practice of actually being able to take what are often quite fuzzy, loose research requests and making sure they can access the historical materials they need. And for what I do now in terms of digital, it's really interesting experience of thinking about, you know, how do you match people's needs with the material that you know is out there? And it makes you realize that often a lot of computer applications do rely on very tightly defined search queries. So, you know, museums will invest huge amounts of money in very sophisticated, multifaceted online collections, yet in practice very, very few people use them. But it's so interesting that, you know, my experience going back, you know, 15, 16 years now, there's no digital application that really has caught that. When you think about the heritage sector at large, you still need to know the information infrastructure to some degree to have the literacy to actually access those materials. That's a problem we haven't really cracked. But basically, I worked in the History Centre for, I think, about 4 or 5 years. And also at the time, I was part of the first wave of people working on digitisation from about 2004 onwards. And my focus was really on the photographic collection, which is partly because I think, apart from the designer, I was the only other person who knew how to use a scanner and Photoshop. But I sort of did that for a few years, and then in 2007 I became a curator of the photographic collection. Did that for about 4 years and worked on two temporary exhibitions and also the permanent Indian Hospital Gallery in the Royal Pavilion. Mm-hmm. And then in 2011 I became the digital lead for Royal Pavilion and Museums, initially with much more of a focus on marketing. But over the years, that has broadened. So actually, I do less about marketing now. I mean, quite a lot in the more broad category of comms, I guess. A big part is around what I call digital publishing. It's how we take the information we hold, the knowledge we have, and express it in audience-friendly forms that we can then make available, usually online, sometimes through other media. Digital publishing is probably the most exciting, biggest part of what I do. Another element is around digital skills. Increasingly, what I found over the years is a lot of my work has shifted from me doing digital things to me actually supporting other people to do digital things, which is quite a sensible shift, I think, in terms of thinking about a mature or digitally mature organisation. It is often me advising on sort of questions, short-term projects, etc., or very often sort of formal training, which I've do both internally within RPM, but also increasingly outside. So I've done quite a bit of work with the, say, Museum Development Service. And so this year I've just started teaching on the Curating Master's degree at Brighton University to help train museum professionals in digital skills, and something I really enjoy. So that's the sort of digital skills element. Digital marketing is part of it, because although I don't get involved in the creation of marketing campaigns and contents, what I still tend to do is advise on a strategic level, and particularly with things around supporting the analytics and helping people really to understand what works and what doesn't. And the last one, which is perhaps a little bit unusual for someone working in digital, but does make sense given the scale of organisation we are, is information management. Mm-hmm. Now, there's sort of two things that brought that into focus for RPM. One, as with many organisations, was the introduction of GDPR back in May 2018. It did scare organisations enough to take this seriously. They deal with quite complex and messy bits of data, particularly when you think about things like social history collections, which can very, very easily have quite intimate details about people's lives captured and have to be sort of treated with, you know, both ethical respect and respect to the law as well. The second trigger for that was actually RPM's move to become a trust. We had to make a case to the council that all the information that the museum manages has to be safely transferred to the new trust. And given how councils are very risk averse and quite skittish around sort of legal compliance and often inclined to simply say no, it's been a lot of work in terms of articulating what information we have, why we have it, why we move it. I'm studying to become a qualified data protection officer, which we need, because, you know, things like CCTV alone is kind of a huge amount of personal information that we have to manage legally. And so it's quite a broad spread.
Wow, thank you. When you were talking about the first two, I was thinking, wow, so you're kind of starting to argue that eventually there won't be a role for you anymore. You're in the business of facilitating and supporting others to learn, and so eventually there won't be a need for a digital manager anymore. But then when you got to the second two, I was thinking, your role is really, really fundamental and will be for a very long time to come.
Yeah, who knows? It's a simple answer to that. I mean, it always seems quite weird when you're working professionally towards your own obsolescence. But at the same time, I think you very quickly realise that the model of, oh, we have a digital person, they'll do the digital things, just simply does not work. You know, as, you know, organisations do more digitally, that model is never going to be sustainable. But I think the real question for me is not so much that the sort of digital manager, digital professionals post within a museum will necessarily disappear, but I think it could splinter and evolve into different disciplines, if you like, different practices. A lot of digital is often about doing things in different ways that we always did. Marketing is not a new activity for museums. There are now just different ways of doing them with their pros and cons. And it's a bit more complicated because things like print media, for example, hasn't gone away. Print media is still very, very effective. But of course, there are digital tools out there that means you can reach audiences in different ways. But in a way there, I think, in terms of the future museums, you really are talking about marketing as a practice evolving to capture and really understand that.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, I think the skills element is quite interesting, because perhaps if there are lots of different complex changes and skill sets and sort of knowledge elements that you think your workforce need, you actually need someone to keep on top of that within mm-hmm. the organisation, to understand the needs, to understand how that will fit into an overall strategy.
Yeah.
So yes, potentially you could absorb that within, I guess, even an HR role or a workforce development role within that organisation, but you would need someone with a very kind of quite rich and deep understanding of the sort of digital culture as much as any technology. For a long time, a museum could really get away with the fact that the focus of what it did was the visit that visitors have when they come into the museum, or perhaps the people who would meet a curator and have special access as a researcher to see those collections behind the scenes. But for me, that is the real substantive change that's happened in museums with the advent of digital, because if a museum fundamentally is there to impart its knowledge and its understanding, and they are learning organisations, the value of that for worldwide audiences is definitely where it is about expressing your knowledge online so wider groups of people can reach them. And I think with a sort of what I call a Victorian accident of a museum like Bright Museum that has all these wild and eclectic collections that, you know, a real legacy of empire and that classic model of people going to the colonies, collecting wonderful things, retiring to the South Coast and then leaving everything to the local museum. It means that we hold possibly very important things for people out there in the world who would never ever know that it's in Brighton.
Mm.
And to really understand how in the knowledge economy we are going to reach those people, you have to move away from any sort of understanding of the museum as being a place. So it's even though formally we have a habit of talking about our website and our web presence as being the sixth museum, it's not entirely accurate, because it's not necessarily a bounded space. It's much more about the diffusion of information across multiple channels in ways in which, you know, we would always like to be recognised as being the source of it, but it's not necessarily that people come to us. You know, so the whole idea of the website, for example, is not that people will, you know, tap in brightmuseums.org.uk and then look through the website to find what they're looking for. Well, you know, that's a completely bogus notion. You know, only about 3% of the people who come to our website ever look at the homepage. It's really about recognising that at the end of the day, people are out there on Google searching for things, and we need to be at the end of that search. Mm-hmm. And that's a really, really simple thing for anyone who understands digital. But if you think about what the essence of the museum is and what it has been traditionally, and the fact that it's working across those much more diffuse, looser channels, and it's no longer the bounded, authoritative space that people will walk into, really is the kind of big change for me around digital. What role does the museum have in the knowledge economy in the 21st century?
Famously, I don't know where I even heard this now, but people often say the museum sector is 15 years behind everyone else in terms of technological development. I'm not sure whether you can say that's right or wrong, really. But could you say something about where RPM has struggled to adapt? From being on the ground, what have you noticed have been the biggest, you know, even if they're quite little things, like what have been the biggest challenges for digital being brought on board at RPM?
I think the first point I'd make is I will say very clearly, the idea that the museum sector is 15 years behind in digital is complete crap, because where is the comparison coming from?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, a lot of investment has been put into digital, very often badly, I think, into, you know, very expensive short-term projects. You know, a lot of people have really been looking at the benefits of digital for museums.
Mm-hmm.
And at the end of the day, everyone is struggling, you know. Also, if you really think about digital transformation, definitely having a website is a big piece of transformation for museums. Certainly having a website you can look on your mobile phone is a major, major difference. I would suggest most other digital technologies have probably had fairly marginal value for museums.
Right.
Partly that's because the essence of the museum experience is around having material culture. So, you know, it is perfectly possible to actually run a very good museum without any digital elements in it whatsoever. Some of the smartest digital museums, like the Rijksmuseum, for example, have barely any digital interactives in it. They have a very good audio guide, but, you know, very savvy about digital, but digital is not everywhere. So I think that's a kind of introduction to my point, where I think RPM has struggled with digital is quite analogous to the rest of the sector, which is just deciding, well, what do we do? Because one of the problems with digital is that it is so pervasive and there are so many opportunities. How do you really decide what you're going to do? More pressingly, how do you decide what is actually going to work? So if I think about the trajectory of my role and how it's actually evolved quite rapidly over the last 7 to 8 years or so, you know, when I started out, it was a lot more about doing digital products. I made, I guess what I would see now in retrospect as being the mistake of actually looking at what were the real currents in digital practice and really trying to do those sort of things in our own way as a way of innovation. You know, one of my big focus areas when I started out was on social media. And I actually neglected doing anything for years with our email newsletter. Yeah, it took me years later to realise that actually people were so much more likely to see anything we put on an email newsletter. It's about, you know, each person who signs up to our e-newsletter is worth about 30 social media followers. So from a very simple information distribution point, whether you're building engagement or knowledge on that, e-newsletters are very powerful. But for years, I ignored that in favour of trying to pursue Facebook and Twitter for, I think, very small returns. So I think one reason why I'm often get quite grumpy about people talking a lot about social media now is I'm a little bit like that person who has given up smoking and can't stand people puffing outside, because I think I've been there and I can see why it doesn't work. It's very easy with digital to create things that sound wonderful on paper, but nobody wants them. You know, there are so many things out there, particularly online, that for you to get the attention space is always going to be very, very difficult. And I feel in some ways it's possibly not until this round of Arts Council funding, which ran from 2018, that I felt we were really able to hammer things strategically into a way that begins to feel that it's coming together a bit better in terms of actually identifying that there are, okay, everything can have a digital element possibly, but there are kind of those four key areas that need to think about where digital is more complicated or transformative. So it's a little bit rambling, but I think probably the kind of broad point I make, which I think is analogous to the sector, was that we were chasing this idea of what digital is. And it's an idea of innovation being what, you know, Jane Finnis at Culture 24 calls the big shiny thing. Mm-hmm. You know, that people can very easily see you've got an app or you've got a crowdsourcing website. And, you know, the fact that it exists is enough for people to feel, great, you're doing digital. And whether it works for audiences or not is becoming secondary, which is always going to be fatal for any public-facing organisation to do that. And you still see this. There's an awful lot of conferences, and I've been guilty of this myself in the past, where people would go up, talk about a case study of something they've been working on, which sounds brilliant, but they seldom tell you how much it cost or how many people actually used it. You know, at a certain point, as a sector, we think, well, we have to be a lot more honest about this.
Yeah. Okay.
So this is really where I think the challenge we've had is around getting to a grip of what, where we need to invest in digital as an organisation, where we will really see the benefits come back. Broadly, I think one of the big, big problems is that in the sector overall, I think digital has almost moved from being opportunity to neurosis. There seems to be a need for everyone to demonstrate that they're doing digital just because it seems to be the thing that we ought to be doing, and we still haven't got a strategic grip on digital. I think as a sector overall, that's not even improving.
Oh, well, this is a punchy statement. I like it. I completely take on your point on board, and I don't think you're alone in thinking that. But you did also just say that it's only in the most recent round of Arts Council strategy writing that you had to report on that you felt you could hammer things more strategically together in terms of digital. Is that because the Arts Council have started to articulate better what they are expecting from organisations in terms of digital? Or is that because you've been here in this capacity, like you said, in the digital lead role for 7 or 8 years, and you've tried out loads of different stuff? You've got all this invaluable experience of what is and isn't working at RPM.
The Arts Council have helped to an extent. So all MPOs for the 2018-2022 round from tier two and above, so that's medium to large size organisations, had to produce a digital policy and a digital plan. Now, there is some use to having a digital policy. I mean, the one we have that I wrote, I refer back to it a couple of times when, say, working with universities around certain research projects. But the problem, to be completely candid, was that the Arts Council, in my view, took the stance that, yes, you need to have a digital policy, it's up for you to decide what you should be, but they're actually quite prescriptive. And I know a lot of very digital savvy people at museums who actually had their digital policies rejected or asked for sort of major changes to them. And it seemed to be there was an expectation that it should follow a template that they suggested, which doesn't really help. And I think even the template they had was a little bit, to me, too much along the lines of digital is really important, therefore we are going to be digital. And you can expand that a little while, but I just don't think that's very helpful. I think having a digital plan probably did help decide what we were going to do structurally. And that was a really difficult thing to write, because what I did not want to do was to have a whole bunch of digital projects. But I think it was really through my experience of looking at what works and what doesn't, and how I'd oscillated between trying to produce digital products on the one hand that didn't always for me give real value for money, to on the other hand finding that essentially handing over ownership of digital projects wasn't always working either, a way of finding a way in the middle to try to do that, to look at those kind of four broad areas to sort of focus on and shift it from there. And that definitely has come through my own experience, really.
I think that's really interesting. There seems to be a narrative emerging out of the policy side, which is saying we need more people from the tech industry or other more corporate or commercial industries to come into the museum sector and show us how to do it. And actually, I think it's really important to make a claim for the importance of actually, no, we need to experiment and iterate ourselves and work out what's best, because we're the museum professionals and we stand up for ourselves as experts of our field, I think is important more than ever.
Yes, I agree. I have no objection to tech companies coming in and supporting what museums are doing, but that only works if you really understand what museum audiences are actually looking for. And that is very complicated. And this is one thing that I think the Arts Council don't quite get. You know, the point is with that, the museum visit, and that's just thinking about the actual on-site visit, let alone online, is a very complex thing. And my experience with working with technologists is they often don't understand that. And it takes a lot of time and a lot of confidence, actually, from a museum professional to tell people that. So it wasn't commercial sector. It was a brief project a few years ago with a university where they were looking at experimenting with new forms of you know, human-computer interface. And the question they ask is, like, what are the things that people like looking at most? And my response to that was they probably don't like looking at things that much anyway, if you think about the overall visitor. We know there are certain things that are more popular than others, like, you know, the Mae West Live sofa in Bright Museum. But the assumption that people go to the museum to look at the things is actually false from the start. So the thing is, you've really got to understand the subtleties and the nuances of visitor behaviour before you can really start building technological solutions. And to give one, that seems like an abstract point, but to give one example where I can already see problems is around the push towards virtual reality. Because, you know, virtual reality is exciting in some ways, can be quite fun. You can certainly understand its application in terms of getting a deeper engagement with history, or at least the kind of historical representation. But does it really work in a museum environment? People I've spoken to have experimented with that. My own experience of having sort of dabbled with little VR bits here and there is essentially VR is probably a home entertainment experience that hasn't picked up a mainstream audience. It actually rubs against the grain of what museum visit is around. Do you really want to come into a public space and then close off lots of your senses to experience something that you could just as easily do at home with a glass of wine? It just doesn't feel like a very fitting thing to do actually inside a museum. There's still expectations that VR is what museums should be doing. And you can do it as a sort of a visitor offer. But I think where it does work, it tends to be something that has a room or a section of a room on its own with someone, a dedicated member of staff there to actually look after the person and the equipment and manage the whole thing. And okay, you can possibly make that work commercially if it's something you charge for, but you really are talking about something that's outside of the overall fabric of what the museum visit is. And again, this is something that technologists don't get. So a couple of weeks ago, a VR company sent round a survey that I took part in, and the assumption was very much, you know, when you're going to start doing VR, framed around the assumption that museums will all be doing VR. Yet,
Why?
You know, yeah, why? And to be honest, there is definitely a tension with the way people actually visit museums. The other thing to bear in mind is that there isn't the money in the heritage sector for a lot of innovation.
Thinking about the responsibility of the museum to think quite carefully about the kind of technologies that they introduce, I guess I'm specifically thinking about this because there's been so much about untrustworthy institutions, big civic public spaces now, and the fact that, you know, there are lots of questions around, can we trust our government and can we trust our schools and all of these kind of things. There's a lot of anxiety around what the institution means, and I've been thinking a lot about the role of the museum as maintaining that kind of safe space. Do you think in the digital question then that museums have got this role to play in actually then thinking quite carefully about the kind of technologies that they interact with? Because it seems at the beginning of digital coming into museums that we were just desperate for help, so we were very keen quickly to get on Facebook, quickly to use Instagram, to get on Twitter, etc., etc. I'm excited by the fact that there is this emerging backlash to that, and that maybe we can start making choices again about what we use. And I wondered about your personal view to do with that, and also where you thought things were headed, and whether you did think there was any possibility to like reclaim agency from inside the museum against some using some of that stuff. And that also then tips into thinking about marketing as well. So it's a big question. I just thought, I'm quite interested in that ethics side of things and thinking about how that affects audiences as well. So I don't know if you can say anything about that.
Yeah, it is a really interesting question. I don't quite know what the answer is yet. I think one of the problems at the moment is for people to really understand the issues around these technologies. So, for example, Facebook, particularly since the Cambridge Analytica scandal, you know, a lot of people know they do not handle people's data very ethically. You know, they may have cleaned up their act, but I think there's a lot of mistrust of Facebook. In fact, I meet very few people who really like Facebook. I mean, they might use it, but they don't necessarily like it. But there's a big, big sort of political side to it. But some of the subtle things people don't get, because it is tied up in things like the distribution practices of social media platforms, the much, much smaller scale things. So something I wrote a tiny piece for in the Museums Journal a couple of months ago is the fact that Facebook, for example, you post something on your Facebook page as an organization, only a very small percentage of your followers will naturally receive it in their feeds. Estimates vary, but it's less than 4%, probably about 2% now, depending on the size of the page. But of course, the way that it filters that content out is towards those people who it will see as being relevant to. You know, it's like a secret sauce. We don't know exactly how the algorithms do that. But the upshot of this is, if you're using a channel like Facebook, information you're putting out there, your content there, is always naturally going to drift towards those people who quite like museums anyway. Mm-hmm. You know, you could be reconciled to that. You could say that's your marketing tactic. That's the demographic that you actually want to get and hold on to. Fine. But there are still a lot of people talking about social media as being a way of reaching new audiences. Now, you can do it through creating content that's very, very shareable, for example, but that's a really, really hard thing to do. And that's often where you're doing some of the work that, say, Museum of English Rural Life did with Adam Kazari when he was there, which was very much witty call and response sort of type of practice. But I think the concern is, if you have other stories to tell that don't quite work in that medium, that format, are quite harder to share, you are stuck in that filter bubble. We're only reaching narrow audiences. Mm-hmm. Now, I think it's really about making people understand where the issues are. Yeah, there's a whole host of them around digital. I think there's the kind of licensing question, where I think we have been able to be quite progressive at RPM, that we actually don't pretend copyright existing works where the original work is out of copyright now. We are quite free and open with them. I think there's also questions around open source technology that we do try to avoid actually locking lots of our information into proprietary systems that would never get them out, which is small scale things but can have ethical dimensions down the river when you're thinking about the kind of loss of public assets.
It seems like the emphasis by the powers that be, as you said, is still on the innovation and on the neurotic side of things, rather than thinking more deeply about some of the bigger issues.
Digital is complicated. It's often not, the technologies themselves might not be that complicated to use. In fact, you know, they're obviously designed so they're not, so more people, as many people can use them as possible. But the issues around it, the dissemination of information, the implications of these things are very, very complicated. And I seem to have been so sort of moany and slightly ranty in what we're talking about.
I didn't really expect, actually.
Or maybe I should have been more moany. Yeah, I think one of my more interesting experiences for learning about digital was actually something called Murder in the Manor, which we did back in 2013. And it was a really nice project that we just started out with the idea of storytelling in a form digitally around Preston Manor. And then I was able to get a very good developer in with a very broad brief. Little Green Pig, who I'm not sure where they're going, is a creative writing group working with young people. And to get them to create an interactive way in which you could explore stories around Preston Manor. And it just went this completely fictionalised route of throwing out any of the truth about Preston Manor and turning it into sort of game, although we ended up throwing most of the game mechanics out, actually, just to kind of let the stories come through, like a sort of fictional murder mystery set in Preston Manor. And, you know, by some measures, that's one of the most successful digital projects I've ever worked for, even though a lot of my colleagues hated it. And even though myself probably in some ways have to really kind of question its value online, you know, why do you produce something that is essentially talking about a history of Preston Manor that never, ever happened? You know, why do you invest so much time in that fictionalised response? Because often I think the argument is made around, you know, work with young people, that you can, you know, do it in short-term projects, you know, use the museum or the collections as a venue for that short-term activity, but it doesn't often have a lot of legacy beyond it. So something that was creating a much more kind of longer-lasting digital experience sort of seemed quite odd. But it did work very well. So, you know, I managed to get invited to both Russia and Spain in different instances on the basis of having done that. People are quite interested in those projects and other things we were doing. And I think it was really amazing. This isn't much of an anecdote, but it was just really interesting as being one of the rare examples I've ever seen of a project where I actually set out the broad scope of what I wanted to do, which was completely technologically neutral, actually. I never said I want to use this, that or the other, but just set out what the ambitions were. And all the other partners came in and fleshed it out in a way that eventually worked very well. And, you know, that thing's, you know, quite old now, that website, and it's kind of propped up a little bit with some sort of jiggery pokery behind the scenes, but it's still good. There's a school in Hong Kong that keeps using it.
Wow.
Presumably for English language teaching. I don't know, but that was kind of, in some ways, one of my favourite projects because it did come together very well. And it was a reminder, I think, one of the kind of subtly exciting things about it was that it did take that work from young people and give it longer lasting value. And I think the point I always felt about that project that a lot of people didn't necessarily get was that if you want people, particularly with digital assets, to think much more creatively about the sort of digitized heritage of museums, you have to actually be quite openly playful yourself to facilitate that sort of culture. And probably where its spirit lives at the moment is a program called Remix the Museum that some of my colleagues work with, where young people are brought in and take either photos of the museum or digitized collections and just really mash them up into really playful animations. And I shamelessly use them whenever I go and give talks about things, because, you know, if I'm talking about something like metadata structures or, you know, digital preservation, maybe, you know, it's quite dull, full of lots of sort of bullet points. And it's sometimes nice if the opening one could at least be a huge lemon dropping down onto the main dome of the pavilion and kind of as if it were a juicer.
And I also quite like what you said about if you want to produce more and encourage people to produce more creative stuff, you have to be playful yourself.
Yeah.
I think there's a lot of bravery in that statement. I think it's not something that gets talked about very openly, that, do you think?
Yeah, it's interesting. I really like playfulness. I mean, this goes back to, you know, my aborted attempt at a PhD and the dissertation I did for my master's degree, which was about video games, but touched a lot on play more widely. And while I think, you know, creating video games is not really a very sustainable option for museums because they're just very expensive to do and a very difficult marketplace to compete in, playfulness you can do cheaply and very effectively. And it's a brilliant, brilliant tool for just actually making people look at your museum through fresh eyes. So, you know, most people, when they ask to kind of picture a museum, if they don't use them very often, will think of dusty old cases in a somewhat darkened room, possibly with a rather officious, grumpy steward in the background. And, you know, that is still the kind of stereotype you're working against effectively. But playfulness can really turn those things on their head. So For me, where digital projects often work are those things that don't necessarily have a huge number of users at the outset, but have a small number of users that can trickle out over a long, long period of time.
It's great to hear you talk positively as well about a technological endeavour.
I think I seem, you know, especially for someone in my role, so sceptical about technology, but I think that's just because the focus on technology for digital is normally where things start to go wrong. And I suppose the theme, I guess, of what I've been saying is it's always, always, always think about the subtleties in human behaviour around this. And increasingly, you know, that's more and more what I do. So something like, you know, 3D scanning of objects, great, I love the things, but what do you do with it? You know, who needs that? Why? You know, and again, that's where actually more playful approaches, something that's, well, obviously long, long predates digital culture, but something that has been perhaps facilitated by digital culture and kind of opened up in new ways, but, you know, playing with your audience or giving your audience the tools and the space to play is so much more exciting because it's rooted in those real behaviours. Yeah. So for me, I think, you know, digital is really about the people first, technology second. If you want a fairly naff soundbite, that's probably your one to go for.
People first, technology second.
Yeah. So, I mean, our policy has this golden rule where basically it comes down to, you know, no conversation about digital should ever start with the technology.
Yeah.
It should always be about, you know, the people primarily first and then the content and then the technology comes in afterwards.
Okay.
But yeah, that's why I think whenever conversations about technology come up, I actually get a little bit bored by it.
Yeah. What's great and not so great about that is that that's taken kind of years of meditating on this stuff and working in this role to come to that conclusion. Good. Okay. In that case, thanks, Kevin.
Pleasure. Hope you can edit that into something halfway worthwhile.
Definitely.
I was rambling. It wasn't very articulate at all. Sorry. But...
Incredible insights from Kevin here. It was a real privilege to hear such a nuanced and considered understanding of what digital can be for a museum service like Royal Pavilion and Museums. I really appreciated listening to what Kevin said about how in the past we've chased an idea of what digital is, obsessing over innovation and technology rather than people. It's savants like Kevin that we need to hear more than ever in the present moment, where lockdown and limited museum reopening has forced museums and heritage organisations to generate more and more online content to mixed degrees of success. People first, as Kevin said, must be the mantra. Let's think of digital as an opportunity, not a neurosis. The next episode is also our last, and I'll be meditating on what is at stake for a regional museum service as we go forward into life post-pandemic and potentially a second lockdown before we get there. I'll be joined by some voices who I believe represent the future of museum work. Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this episode, hit like and subscribe, and please leave us a very nice 5-star review. Find out more about the Royal Pavilion Museums at brightonmuseums.org.uk and more about this project at oneby1.uk. On Twitter, I'm Soph_Frosty, and RPM is Brighton Museums. I really hope you can join me next time. Till soon, goodbye.
The voices of the Royal Pavilion and Museums are supported by the oneby1 Research Project, the School of Museum Studies at the University of Leicester, The Keep, Arts Council England, and produced by Lo-Fi Arts.